Welcome to the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin, your source for real estate investment jewels of wisdom.
Welcome to the REI Diamond Show. I'm your host, Dan Breslin, and this is episode 159 on how to succeed in business without sacrificing your family, health, or life with David Finkel. David Finkel is the author of The Freedom Formula and co-author of Scale, 7 Proven Principles to Grow Your Business and Get Your Life Back, written with Priceline.com co-founder Jeff Hoffman, and one of the nation's most respected business thinkers, a Wall Street Journal and Business Week best-selling author of 12 books. David is a regular columnist for Inc.com, FastCompany.com, and Forbes.com, reaching more than 1 million readers per year. Over the past 20 years, David and the Maui coaching and advisor team have scaled and sold over $62 billion of businesses. An ex-Olympic level athlete turned business multimillionaire, David and his wife, Heather, and their 3 sons live a simple life in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. As someone so instrumental in my early success as a real estate investor, David is a guest that I have been looking forward to having on the show for quite a while. David co-authored the book originally that I read, helping me do my first few deals as a real estate investor back in 2006. Since then, I've done well over 1,000 more, and David has shifted his focus from real estate investing to helping business owners scale their businesses, some to $1 billion and more. Shall we jump right in? All right. Welcome to the REI Diamond Show, Mr. David Finkel. How are you doing today?
I'm doing really well, Dan. Thank you for having me on.
For sure. So I'm recording from Chicago. Most of my listeners know that. It's a beautiful day out here. Finally, early summer. Shutdown's just ending to kind of timestamp our episode in history. But whereabouts are you recording from? And maybe give us a little background, David, on how your real estate investing had turned into the multiple businesses along that line to ultimately what your main business is today.
Absolutely. So I live in a small town called Jackson Hole, Wyoming. My wife and I moved out here with our young kids. I've got 2 kids that are 11 and 1 kid, all sons, who is 7. And it's just a really lovely place to raise a family. I started off real estate. Well, first of all, I started off in business, which my first company was about investing in real estate. And so that was back 24 years ago, investing in single family houses. And over the course of about 10 years, bought, sold, lease optioned several hundred houses. We were doing about 150 to 250 houses a year. And we also had a coaching business that taught people how to do that. I sold that in 2005. And I still invest in real estate to this day, apartment complexes, real estate-backed debt, commercial real estate. And then I run my main business right now is we work helping established business owners scale and grow their own companies. And we do that with our business coaching program, teaching people how to build a business, not just own a job. And that's what I've been doing now for about 15 years.
All right, cool. So I have 2 David Finkel stories we're going to start off with here, which is cool because it's been life-changing for me, and some of my like close business partners and things have known some of these stories here in the past. But so we'll start with the first one that was I thought it was 2006 or 7 because I had went to a real estate investing, get rich in real estate seminar, kind of I think it was Russ Whitney at the time. And sure. I don't know how, I think it was your office. Maybe it was after the company was sold, but I get a call out of the blue, the sales guy, and he's looking to sell me, coaching. At the time, it was kind of like me scratching the dirt trying to get started, so I couldn't afford to take the plunge. But the salesperson's like, hey, I can send you a book. And I'm like, this kind of sounds like a scam. I don't know. And he talked it over. He sent me making big money in foreclosures without the use of your own cash or credit.
Oh, my gosh. That's an old one. Okay.
So that was 2007. It was probably a few years old at the time. But the style of storytelling combined with the actionable items in there, I bought the other. I think there's probably 10 or 12 other books that I have bought and read like in succession behind that. And like I said, I was on a limited budget, but those seeds, especially that book, I remember like I was on a bus on the way to a business meeting, and I felt like inspired enough that I was like, man, I could just get off this bus and start like knocking on the door and making deals. I didn't do that. It eventually I made deals other ways with some of the techniques that were actually talked about in that book. But this will lead me into the second David story. And so some of what I want to kind of point out there is in those books, in that book, the story, the information, the whole packaging of it, kind of was planting seeds of belief. And then later on, you and I actually hopped on a coaching call together. This is a few years later. I kind of took a lot of punches in the market, never developed a real business. So it took me a good few years before I was able to build a sustainable business like I'm blessed to have today. You, I think, had another book going. It was kind of another cold call thing, and it was like a one-time coaching call thing. And you and I spent, 15, 20 minutes on the phone, and I was not doing a bunch of deals. I had a few flips going. I was doing a little bit of wholesaling, and your lesson for me, it was like, hey, you know, how much is it worth if you're in there doing the work yourself on the house, which is something that I was doing. And I'm like, well, I don't know. I'd probably try $20,000 a month, like in a couple deals. And the net result of it was you had assumed I was making $300,000 a year, and I was not at the time. You're like, well, that's worth $300,000. And you kind of made these quick observations and connected the dots. And I don't even know that the takeaway you were trying to instill was the belief, but I remember thinking like, man, if this guy thinks I can make that kind of money, I think I'm thinking about my business in a different way that somebody with that third party perspective kind of brings a whole nother level of like depth and belief. And I'm probably talking, I don't know, coaching 101 in the basics compared to the actual nuts and bolts of what happens with you and your clients. But I thought I'd set the stage with my own experience with my limited, you know, knowledge or David Finkel coaching experiences, just to kind of say that that you're the real deal and you're doing the businesses that you're doing. And a lot of what we're getting ready to talk about on this episode is battle worn and very well thought through and tested strategies. And just kind of before we get into the meat of all that, really kind of put the stamp on it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, Dan, I really appreciate that. Two quick comments with that. So first of all, And listeners will hear this today, I've always been the person who wants to tell people not what to do, but the how to do the what to do. Because I found that very frustrating for me. I'm a process person. And when I would read stuff that would tell me do X or Y, but it didn't tell me how to do that, I just got mad at that. And I'm a big reader myself. Number two, I think it's interesting, you know, the coaching conversation, which I really appreciate you bringing up. I hadn't remembered that. But it's interesting to me, whenever I'm talking to somebody, whether it be directly or as part of a live workshop or on the phone, what strikes me as interesting is how often there is a small glaring leverage point in somebody's business, whether that be, you know, in a business renting out single family houses or doing fix and flips or a professional business of different sort, that they can't see themselves. They're so close to it. It, when you point it out to them and you do some rudimentary business math to show them what the value of fixing this, changing this, or doing this is, oftentimes it can just be revolutionary for them. And so I hopefully we'll get to doing some of that today.
Yeah, for sure. And so while we're on the mindset of what we're talking about here early before we start talking nuts and bolts and the how-to processes, I remember a story, I think it was about you doing a 400 meter sprint and you're like 80 seconds. And then I forget exactly how it went down. Maybe you could tell me the story with the breaking of the mental barriers there.
I appreciate that. This is a story I told in my most recent book, The Freedom Formula. And specifically what it had to do with was I was talking about the context of there are two economies operating in the world. We call it the time and effort economy and the value economy. And our mental models of the world change how we behave. And I gave an example. A long time ago, I'm almost 50 now, so I'm 49 turning 50 this year. So I'm not that way now. But back in a time, I was an Olympic level athlete. I played field hockey in the U.S. national team. Captain the team, was going to play in the 96 Olympics. And I got hurt. Well, back when I first started playing with the national team, where I was on the alternate, on the squad, but not on the team, I was training with the national team. And I was 16, 17 years old, training with men that were 20 to 26 years old. And so after sessions, our coach would have us go to the track, and we would run interval sprints, 200 meters, 400 meters. And I had just gone through a growth spurt. My times in those sprints were like 75, 78, 80 seconds, which is horrible. The rest of the team would come in 10, 15, 20 seconds before me, depending on the day. And I kind of imprinted that I must be slow. There was one day, though, I remembered, this was about 2 years after I started training with the national team, the coach pushed me to get in the front of that pack. And normally I just would gravitate to the back so I wouldn't get trampled. And for whatever reason, I'm in the front, and I still remember the rhythm of breathing. I come in there that first sprint, I'm at 66 seconds. So I took a full 15 seconds off my normal times, which is impossible. You can't make a 400-meter sprint go 15 seconds faster than you were yesterday. Except what it means is I always had those faster times in. The next sprint, 67 seconds. The next set, 66 seconds. And it just totally jarred or changed the way. It broke open the way that I saw myself. And from that point, I realized as an athlete, I actually was fast. But during the time that I had learned that I was slow, that was my model for myself. And of course, it made sense. I had grown 4.5 inches in 1 year. I was a gangly puppy that was growing into his feet. But once I had grown into them, I still had that old model. And a lot of people are operating their businesses, whether they're investment businesses or whatever, they're operating it under an old model that no longer serves them. And if they can break open that model, the results can change very quickly. And I don't mean that as woo-woo stuff, because I'm not that way at all.
No, for sure. The business model, the mental model, both of them, I just know from my own experience. I don't really have a top of mind example. I guess I do. So like we kind of like leverage my company started back when you and I were on the phone. I'm like embarrassed when I took that coaching call. I was not, seated at my desk, pen and paper in hand, the holy sacred space to do business and like conduct intelligent conversation. I was like driving on my way to the rehab, and I hope I pulled the car over at least to have the conversation. I'm like embarrassed, right? That was probably 2011, 2012, somewhere around there. Today I have a total of, it's over 30 people all told. We have, vice presidents running each of our three markets. We did over 220 something houses last year. We're like closing in on 100 so far this year. I think we're already at like 2 million in profit, which we split up. So in a sense, that's more of like a revenue number that goes amongst all the partners there. But we've been able to kind of leverage. But early on for me, the leverage point, the model in my mind was like, hey, I'm like generating these leads and like, I don't want anyone else to go out there and like screw this up. So I will run and see every single house and make every single offer and make every single decision. And there came a point that I had to release the reins on that, and somebody, one of the newer partners at the time would go out and screw up an obvious deal that we should have had and should have been closed. So I had to deal with some of those pain that I was afraid of, but ultimately the growth that came on the heels of it once we were able to better train and systematize and put things in place, breaking that model for us kind of led to the next level, which leads me into my next question that I have as you were talking there. And like the average real estate investor, David, they're buying, they're renovating, they're selling houses, or maybe they're doing, at least in my network and in my world here, or they're buying rental properties and doing refinances. And it's a pretty steady conventional. We're not doing too much, terms, lease option deals. People were either fixing and flipping houses and buying them cheap and putting into construction, selling, making a profit, or they're buying that needs some work, putting some work in, and then refinancing their cash back out, and it's kind of a rinse and repeat with the goal of getting a few hundred of those, I guess, at some point.
Yeah.
And I'm sure there's a variety in there. But I know that a lot of people like that who are probably listening to the episode right now are thinking, yeah, I'm kind of the guy that has to do everything. I've got to manage all this. I mean, do you have like a next level for somebody who's investing like that? Is there sort of an example that you might be able to talk about?
Absolutely.
Like a different model?
Yeah, I'm going to hit it with both the mental model and I'm going to hit it with just the control-itis that you mentioned. So first of all, I'm going to share it with a story. His name's RC. So RC is a client of ours. We've coached him for years. He has a flipping business where he'll buy, rehab, and then resell properties in Northern California. Today, his business does probably 100, 110 rehabs a year. That wasn't always the case, but it means a substantial business. In his area, he's the big guy. He advertises on TV and other places, and he's got a great business. But I remember when we first started working together, a couple of things that were going on there. One was, you know, this thing of control-itis, this inflammation of your control gland that causes you to stay trapped in the business. So he would work from 7 a.m. to pretty much 9 or 10 at night. He'd be at home with his wife, and at that time he had two kids. He's got three now. And you know, his cell phone would go off, and he would have the ads that would run straight to his cell phone. All of his tenants had his cell phone number. All of his construction crews had his cell phone. Everyone had his cell phone. We called this the phone. His wife is the nicest person you'll ever meet, Dahlia. And he was just resigned, and she was resigned that this is the way it had to be. And I remember challenging him on that. I said, look, you can't get rid of the phone today, but over the next 120 days, we can unpack this phone, and we can get rid of 90% of those phone calls. And he says, that sounds great, but you're full of it, David. There's no way. It's impossible. Business couldn't survive it. I said, well, can't survive it now. But so we went through a certain process. First of all, we said, okay, the tenant calls. Do you really need to be the one to receive the tenant calls? He had professional property management, but he just had trained his tenants to call him on his cell phone. It was ridiculous. And construction crews, he had a person who was at the time, I think it was three crews that he had. Now he's got five. But he had a guy, his name is Joe, who was in charge of his construction crews. Why in the world would he even have the number? And so we talked about it, and we looked for, do we want to give your cell phone number to somebody else, or how do we want to do this? So we got rid of the crew calls, the construction calls from the rehabs. They went to Joe, and we got rid of the other. The hardest one for him to get rid of, he'd been trained that when that phone rang, similar to what you said, he heard dollar signs ring because he was so good on the negotiation by this point. And I looked at it with him. He had three people who were, in theory, supposed to be buyers for him, but he didn't give them the ability to take any of those leads. You know, they could look at the auctions for him or the other places for him, but not that phone. And slowly we started to build the process and train one of his people to take over that phone for him. And I'll just fast forward to the end of the story. A year later, he took 7 weeks off during the summer, and his business did really well during that time away. It wasn't perfect, but it went well. The next summer, he took another 7 weeks off, and the business really ran incredibly well. We were even better situated. He trained his people. He brought in internal business systems for them to follow. He unpacked things. That's one piece. But here's the second piece where mindset also hurt him. When he first started doing deals, he had no track record. So when he needed money, he would find someone who would lend him the money by basically coming into the deal as a 50-50 partner. Well, when I met him, I said, RC, his name's RC, why in the world are you still doing deals on a 50-50 split? You now have done hundreds of these. You have a track record, but you're still operating on that old model, kind of like I was. I was operating on the model I was slow. I could only do a 75, 78-second sprint. I said, now this is wrong. And so we looked at some conventional sources of financing on a blanket mortgage that he picked up some money that way. We looked at his money sources of how he could renegotiate or find new people who come in and at a 25% stake to a 33% stake versus 50%. And just by changing that model to update it to where he was, he made an extra $500,000 of profit by reducing his cost of capital. And again, a lot of times the world, we still interact with the world under this old model of, well, gosh, I have to give away half for the money person. Well, I did when I was originally doing it when they had more risk, but now I'm a machine. They would be more than happy to accept a 25% of the deal, or I can find a conventional lender who will lend against some other security and some equity that I now have in other properties, and I can keep that money working myself, and my cost of capital might be at, you know, a blended rate of somewhere between 8 or 10% cost of capital versus, you know, a quarter to half of the deal. So those are some examples from that part of it that we need to keep updating how we see our business and our place in that business world, because it changes a lot. And whether it be how we feel about controlling the business, because truthfully, he never controlled the business. The business owned him. He didn't own the business. Today, it's very different. He owns the business. He's in control of it in a way that he never was before.
How long was that progression that you just described, David?
Yeah, so the easy one, like I said, I always look, we call it low-hanging fruit. We always look for these low-hanging fruit. The easy one was his cost of capital. It was just obvious. So you know, he can't see it for himself because he's too close to it. He's scared. But from the outside looking in as a, you know, as a coaching team, it was just obvious. So we went back and we just looked at it and said, well, who are you borrowing money from? And he listed off these different people, what rates are, he was giving them, what percentage of the deals, how much money they had that they were keeping him working with. We looked at what his equity position was. And so we helped him get the blanket mortgage. That was an obvious one. We helped him go and say, well, look, with this blanket mortgage, you don't need all your private lenders, your private money partners. You probably need about a third of them. So this is a no-brainer. All you have to do is go to your people who were taking half the deal and say, look, hey, I can't work with you anymore because I have other people who are willing to do it for 25% stake or a third stake in the deal. But I really liked working with you. You're a good person. And I felt I had to give you the opportunity to be with me under these new terms first before I, and he did this and he got plenty of money. That was easy. That was less than what, about 3 months, 90 days. The other one took more time. And so where we started was, is we started looking at what internal systems did he already have. And it turned out that most of the systems they had were just in people's heads. They weren't actually written out. So there's a process, we call it the UBS process, by which you create your business system. So we started capturing what those systems were in writing in an organized way. We can talk about that later on. At the same time, we looked at where were the phone calls coming from. And they were coming from four places, from tenants, from his vendors, in this case, his mostly his contractors, from his advertising. And then the fourth category were these miscellaneous people that were trying to sell him stuff or just get his phone number because it's in the community. So great. The tenants, we just need to retrain them. And how do we make a good system there? We don't give them the number ever again. I mean, I actually suggested to him that he just change goes it and declares a phone number bankrupt, which is buy a brand new cell phone, get a new number, keep the old number, yeah, but have it go somewhere else, right? But he didn't want to do that. I guess there was some sentimentality there. The contractors, you know, just tell them to call this other person. If they call you, you simply redirect them back to the other. It's kind of like the kids. Like in my household, I'm pretty strict. My wife is pretty permissive. My kids ask me for something, I say no. Of course, they're going to go straight to my wife, Heather, and say, can we do this, Mom? And of course they are. So when he has a person call him, his contractor, he's got to be strong and say, you know what? You need to call Joe. You shouldn't be calling me for that. Joe's the guy you got to call. And then finally, the harder one was the advertising. And so we changed some of the numbers that were, they were toll-free numbers that he pointed to a cell phone, so it was easier functionally. And what we did was we said during business hours, go ahead and take the calls. We'll start there. You know, you'll make a lot more money. You can negotiate better. But during after hours, make a little bit less, and I don't think you would over the long term. It turned out he didn't, but he was afraid he would. After hours, point the number to one of your buyers. Let them hand the calls. And they're thrilled to do it because they're going to make money themselves. They're going to make some commission money by closing some deals that way with some great leads. And let's see how this goes. And over the course of about another 4 months, he felt good enough to let that go. He still took calls when he was doing business. When he was in the office, he didn't mind taking the calls then. Neither did his wife, Dahlia. But on nights and on weekends, that's when he wanted to reclaim. And I'll tell you, 2 years into this process, Dan, he was working reduced hours. His hours were he'd get to the office about 8 o'clock and he would leave by 2 or 3 in the afternoon. Totally different from where he was before. And he just did this in an incremental way. He didn't do it all at once. You know, this isn't an on and off switch. It was a kind of like a rheostat, kind of going up brighter, 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 bit by bit.
So I think it's a perfect time for you to dive. First, define UBS. I know what it is, but for the listeners.
Yeah. So for any listener for this, the term UBS comes from 22 years ago, a business partner and I were building our real estate company, and we said we want to build this to be systems-driven. Matter of fact, we want to build it so that we have great business systems, and we loved acronyms, Dan, so we used the acronym for business systems, and we were a little embarrassed by it. BS is not a great acronym. So we added the word ultimate in front of it, and that's where we got UBS. And so the UBS stands for, it's a structured way of where you store, access, create, refine, and when need be, delete systems. And so the way this works is, I think to myself in my business, okay, this is a collection of cloud-based file folders that I'm going to have on Dropbox or on Google, or we use a service called Ignite. Other people might use Microsoft, Box.com, whichever they want to use. Any of those services now are ubiquitous. Back then, there was only one service that really did this well, a company called Groove that eventually was bought out by Microsoft. Now there's a lot better solutions than that. But we create this hierarchy. For example, folder 1.0 will be for sales and marketing, my lead generation for new deals. Folder 2.0 will be about the negotiation and closing of deals, the underwriting of the deals, the due diligence. 3.0 will be on the financing or funding of deals. 4.0 will be about the ongoing property maintenance and management. So I create folders this way for my real estate business. And then I pick one folder to start with. Say, let's say I want to work on my property management over time folder, the folder that says the ongoing operation of my properties. Great. I load it with whatever systems I currently have. I go and see on everyone's separate hard drives on their computers. I go and say, what do you have on your computer that you're using to run your part of our property management side? And some people have a checklist for move in and move out. Somebody else says, well, I have this script I've been using when somebody calls me about an apartment or calls me about renting a house. Someone else says, you know, I have a really good document I have that has all the SKU numbers for the paint and for the fixtures that we use in a unit so that our people can standardize that. So we put it all in one place. And we look at it and we just ask the question, if I could only build one system this quarter in the next 90 days, what one system would be most valuable for our business in this area of the company to build? Or we ask it the opposite way, Dan. We say, which one system costs us the most not to have? And I build that. And it starts off slow, because there might be just one or two people kind of doing this work. But eventually, you're going to get different people doing the work, and it happens very fast. And I'll give an example for it. We work with these two guys that are, their names are Charlie and Jack. They're based out of Florida, and they started off buying houses, from houses to duplexes and triplexes, and from there, small apartment complexes. They ended up with over 1,000 units in this really kind of mishmash collection. And these are guys that were when we first started working together in their early 60s, and they're, you know, hang on a second here. If we weren't here, no one could run this thing. This business is not a business. It's just a collection of properties that we somehow managed to hold together with a little bit of you know, shoestring and a little bit of wax and a little bit of chewing gum. So over the last 4 years, we've been working with them. They've gotten a couple of their kids involved. They've started to build a management team with that part. And the business is such that they don't have to do anything in there other than what they love and do best, which is negotiate new deals and sell properties. That's what they do that makes the most value. They buy new stuff, make decisions about that, and they make decisions about how they're going to sell and what they're going to sell. But they have a really robust system in place. And what happens is, usually the owner of the business is not the person who's going to be good at the systems anyways. Like, my company does not want me creating systems. Why? I'm good at framing them out, but I get bored by it. I don't want to put all the details with it. So Teresa, Larry, Kim, Bethany, all these people who work for me, they do it much better. And so version 1.0 might have been years ago I created, you know, a checklist. Well, nowadays that checklist might be really decked out with hyperlinks that go over to, you know, video-based training about how to do each of the steps and what to look for. Standardized contracts would be another example. So these are all things that I do, but I do it incrementally, bit by bit, by starting with one area of my UBS, then the next and the next. And if someone who's listening to this, Dan, wants to get a hold of how we approach that, I would really point them to my last book, The Freedom Formula. There's a section there, as you know, I know we talked about you've been reading that, that goes through and describes, and I believe it's chapter 4, Strategic Depth, that goes through how to do that and kind of lays it out visually.
Yeah, you're right about that. And one of the things, too, as a side, you've always been good at like laying things out in the entire book in a very, very useful and methodical fashion. I commend your writing style.
Thank you.
You must write them yourself. I think when people ghostwrite the books, there's not the same depth of detail. that I find in all the books going all the way back to the 2000s when I first found your work. But as an aside, good job on that. Thank you for putting that kind of effort and detail in there. I want to put an underline under the last piece. So when I read it, when I heard it, when you were talking about the UBS this time, you had mentioned that it's an evolving system, and a big light bulb went off for me. I think because I think that, like, when we share some of our systems with our team, you know, a year, 2 years, 3 years ago, we like bring the system out, everyone kind of adopts it, and then they get off course a little bit, and then all of a sudden we revisit it, and it's, oh man, this thing is like really outdated. And just the fact that the UBS, the ultimate business system, is this like fluid, ever-changing, team should ever be paying attention and re-referencing, even though they say, yeah, I read that system, you know, last year when I started doing this thing, like perhaps there's this update that came down maybe by Teresa or whoever in the company, or maybe I dipped in myself and changed and modified its tweak. So the fact that it's like an evolution in process is kind of, I don't know, one of the heartbeat drivers, I think, of the business's ability to continue to scale, grow, and do better what they are already doing. Very useful also is the numbering system. So that's something that I began doing. And it's like by labeling it one, marketing, two, negotiation, three, operations, it rather than putting your files in alphabetical order by default, it puts them in an order that you can kind of, you know, choose a priority. And I feel like you can put like a priority thinking is big for me. Priority of certain components of the business, perhaps that I'm working on at the time, perhaps that are, you know, instrumental to the business's success, I might put as my first folder. Then second folder, third folder, et cetera. But in the same line of thinking, David, with the priority thought process, and this is something I observed throughout the entire Freedom Formula book, I think even going way back in a lot of your older stuff also, I think I remember also hearing that same kind of thing, but there's always this search for the highest value, skill, time investment, operation, way of doing things. There's always like the search for the higher value, the prioritization, kind of the 80-20 rule, but I think you have a more eloquent and deeper way of sort of discussing that. Do you want to elaborate on that thought process and how that works?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, most people have distinctions around time, as you and I know, Dan, that which is it a work day or is it a weekend? That's most people's distinction around time. And some other people, especially if they come from a professional background, might think about billable versus non-billable time, or others might think about this 80-20 rule, this Pareto's principle, saying that, oh, 20% of what I do gives me 80% of the return, and 80% of what I do gives me 20%. And if we play with that distinction, we can actually get that rule to be really taken to its most productive extreme. So if this 80% mass of what I do, I'll call it D time, creates very little value, just 20% of the result, and 20% of what I do is this leveraged 20% gives me 80% of the value. Think about that. That's 1/4 less, creating 4 times more. That's 16 times more valuable. Every hour of C time is 16 times more valuable than an hour of D time. And that's great, but if that's true, let's take that and apply that formula again. 20% of that 20% says, we call this B time, this magic 4% sweet spot that generates 64% or 80% of the 80%, which is 64% of the output. And if the people would just bear with me for one more math moment, if we take that A time, which is 20% of that 20% of the 20%, and say that gives me 80% of the 80% of the 80%, what it works out to be is that 1%, that magic 1%, gives me half the result. And I like to think about that rather than an 80-20 rule. I like to think about it as the 1-to-50 rule, which is that 1 hour of time that gives me half the result that I might get in that period. I mean, it's amazing. It might be the phone call that gets me a deal this month that's huge, or it might be sitting down at a meal with a prospective money partner and, like RC did, renegotiating from a half split to a 25% profit split. And you multiply that by, you know, 12 deals that I do with this person this year, that two-hour lunch might have made me an extra $300,000 of profit this year, or some large number. So when I think about my work, the question becomes, how do I get time to do A and B stuff? And the key is, A and B activities, you need blocks of your best time. It's really hard to go, like, for example, I think about kids. I can't go to my kids and say, hey, I've got 5 minutes free here, guys. Let's have five magical minutes of magic right now. My kids are going to look at me like I'm insane, right? The only way I get magic with my kids is I spend enough time that I can have some of that magic. I need blocks of time with my kids. Well, same thing with my business, my investing company. So what we call it focus days and push days. So what we're going to do is we're going to start off by picking one day a week. And let's say Tuesday. And on Tuesday, I'm going to block off a 2 to 3 hour focus block somewhere in the morning time on Tuesday, or whenever I'm at my sharpest, my best. And during that 1, 2, or 3, or 4 hour block, I'm only going to be doing an A or B level activity. That's it. And then my push days, I'm just doing the normal things that keep the business going. I'm checking on my construction crew, or I'm making sure that we've collected rent this part and keeping our economic occupancy up, or whatever it might be. On my focus days, I give myself a good 2 to 4 hour block. On my push days, I come back and say, how can I carve out as a recurring appointment on my calendar 1 hour as a focus block? And if I do this here, I might only get 5 to 6 hours a week starting initially of focus time. But if I do that, and I'm really good about picking one or two things to do using that time for, working on a new deal finding system, working on a new template for the contracts that we're using for our purchase contract, working on our UBS, working to train somebody to handle leads coming in as a buyer leads or sales leads for properties we're going to buy. If I use that time well, I can create a huge return where those 5 hours this week might create more value than all the other hours combined. Think about it. 5 hours per week of my very best time in blocks focused on my highest value activities, that's an extra 5.5 weeks per year, assuming a 48-week year. That's huge. I'm going to get 5.5 extra weeks of working weeks of 40 hours to do my very best activities. That's how you can grow a company without having to work nights and weekends and while you, quote, are on vacation, close quote.
Gotta love those vacations.
That's right.
What questions, and let's widen the scope on this question here, David, to include any clients whatsoever that happen to come across your desk, your team's desk, et cetera. But what questions would you ask any client to discover that business owner's highest value A or B activities? How do you lead them? What questions would you ask them to get them to come to the conclusions of it's this or it's this I need to fill these focus blocks with?
Yeah, well, let's do it by doing it for real here. So, Dan, I want you to think about your real estate company. I know you do a lot of wholesaling of deals. That's great stuff. So in your business, what's the one limiting factor, the biggest limiting factor more than anything else that slows down the growth of your company? Is it not having enough leads coming in, or is it I've got plenty of leads, but we don't have enough sales capacity to actually convert the leads into deals? Or, hey, I've got plenty of that, but I don't have enough buyers on the other side to buy these contracts? Or what's the single ingredient that if you had more of X, your business would immediately and automatically be able to grow quickly?
I honestly think we're blessed and it is immediately growing quickly and we're in a really unique spot. But to play along with what we have here, let's call it structure and systems and being able to train up people who have lower experience levels and bring them up to speed so that they get a multiple of, say, 10 on their experience, meaning 1 year experience under our coaching and guidance equals 10 years of experience of under someone else's or on their own experience level.
Got it. So I'm hearing from you that you have plenty of leads, you have the ability to convert, you have good structure, but what you're missing here is if you had your staff getting up to speed faster, new staff getting up to speed faster, that you would have more capacity to do more deals. Now, specifically, if you could only have one functional role in your company get up to speed faster, which one role would be most valuable for you? the people doing the buying, the people doing the marketing, the people doing the tenant management, the people doing the underwriting, the people doing the selling of the contract to a wholesale buyer of the deal. If you could only have one function get up to speed faster than you currently have, what one function would have the most value to your business immediately if you could have that be 10 times faster, how you bring them up to speed?
Yeah, ours is the buyer, and that is the experience, and we are putting in place the systems to bring that up already, so it's a continuous work in process. It's kind of like the evolutionary UBS for us. So it's something that we have very capable system already in place, and our guys are way up the curve in a very rapid speed, but I feel like, yeah, there's always room to improve, and that's why we're focused there. So magic wand
Perfect.
Over that, you know, to make it better. Great.
So what we've just done, just to kind of let people hear that, though, this is a real life case study, right? So we take a successful business, in this case, it's your business, Dan, and of all the places you could put your company's best talent, attention, and money, the place that would have the biggest payoff is on how quickly and how fast you can bring your buyers up to speed to more capably close more deals from the lead flow that you already have. That's great. With that, now what we do is we call it a sweet spot analysis. And of course, you know what this is because you read the book, but those that haven't, it's chapter 3, focus on your fewer better. And the sweet spot analysis is a great tool to pick the best ideas, your sweet spot ideas, to solve a challenge or to seize an opportunity. So in your case, it's an opportunity. If we can bring your buyers up to speed even faster, a new buyer up to speed, where it might take, in the past it took you 2 years, if I can bring them up to speed in 6 to 8 months that they're productive or something like that, how valuable that be. So what I do is I brainstorm with my team all the ideas we have to bring our buyers up to speed even faster. You know, people come up with ideas like, oh, we could create a video-based training system. Oh, we could have a mentoring program internally that our people go out with other people. Oh, we could create some better collateral tools that would take some of the heavy lifting of explaining to a seller about how we work with them. We come up with all these ideas. We put them on a list. And then we take our list of brainstorm ideas, a minimum of 10, ideally 15 or more, and I put them through two filters. The first filter is the low-hanging fruit filter. And I ask of every potential idea we have to push back that limiting factor, I ask, is this a low-hanging fruit? And what that specifically means is easy to do, high likelihood of working. Is this a low-hanging fruit? Is this a low-hanging fruit? If it is, on the worksheet that we use, you just check the box for LH, standing for low-hanging fruit. And then I go in a second separate pass and put every idea through second filter. The second filter is the home run filter. If this idea works, will it move the needle big? Will it have a big impact? And if it is, I check the HR for home run box. And what I look for is out of my 19 ideas, I look for the one, two, or three ideas that are both low-hanging fruit and home runs, which by definition, that's your sweet spot. And I can pick one or more of those ideas and implement them in the next 60, 90 days, and it'll have a big impact. That's where the best talent, creativity, attention in your company should go to grow it. So one of the things we do with our coaching clients is every quarter we review what's the current biggest limiting factor, capital L, capital F, limiting factor, and how do we push that back this quarter? And we do it quarter after quarter after quarter in a relentless way, and that's how you get explosive growth with it. That's one way of spotting that.
I love it. Interesting. I hope everyone listening got as much value out of it as I am currently getting, which is ironic because I read the book. But as I hear you describe it again, the sweet spot announcer, for some reason it didn't click at the same level. I must have zoned out there for a second. So I appreciate you bringing that up to speed there. Cool. So, all right, let's take it down a level. Let's say that our buyers are the people who are, you know, my buyers are my partners. These are not like employees. We don't like treat them as such. We're doing like very generous splits with our people, and we try. One of my own business philosophies is to create a humongous opportunity for the people that I am in business with. I want to be a rainmaker, and I want to create an opportunity that's large, invigorating, and provides the same career, community, and calls so that everybody feels fulfilled, not just from making money, but we're doing good with the business work that we're doing. That aside, how would we take, you know, someone who's, you know, taking the inbound calls from advertising and they're negotiating with sellers in the living room, someone who's doing the nuts and bolts of getting contracts signed, and perhaps they're also doing, you know, dispositions and dealing with buyers, same person. What would be the A, B, C, and D kind of thing for them? I mean, they got emails coming in all the time, texts coming in. How could they maybe prioritize some of that?
So let's say I've got Sean who works for me, and Sean's one of my buyers. I've got three buyers who work for my investment company. He's one of them. Great. So when I look at what Sean does, what does he do that creates the most value? Well, the biggest thing he does is he buys or puts under contract really good deals. That's what he does that creates the most value. Also, what he does is he helps find the buyers who want to buy those contracts on an assignment. That's also a place he finds that creates the most value. Now, you might say that you might, maybe we centralize our marketing. So he might be in a different city. He's my quote-unquote partner in the city, Philadelphia or Chicago or wherever he's at. So he's my partner there. So maybe I centralize the marketing. So what does he do that creates the most value? He puts deals under contracts and resells the contract. Okay. What activities within there are the activities that create the most of those results? Well, him sitting down face-to-face with a motivated seller who has some equity in their property. If we buy at a discounted price for cash, if that's our model, versus buying with a flexible terms or owner financing, they need to have some equity. So he sitting down with a qualified, motivated seller is one of the highest activities that he has. Great. Hearing that, what I can also do with him is I can create a simple metric. A metric is a number that helps focuses somebody's attention and energy on their highest value activity. So in this case, when I have a sales team person, and in a sense, this function of buying and selling property, that's the sales function. There's a metric that we use. I've used this with hundreds of business coaching clients over the years, not just in real estate, but I've used it, you know, professional service firms, manufacturers, construction companies, and we call it DST. It stands for direct sales time. And so I have my salespeople track what's the number of hours per week that they're spending in direct sales time. And direct sales time is defined as, in this case, in real estate like this, this would be Sean in the physical presence or on the phone with a seller or a buyer about a deal. Anything else doesn't count. You know, getting directions, doing research on the building or the property, that doesn't count. All that counts is how many hours per week is he getting in the presence of and sitting down with or over the phone or video conference in today's world with a prospective homeowner who's going to sell us a house or a buyer who's going to buy one of our contracts or buy one of our properties. And what you find is that it's shocking. The first time I start measuring it, that number is pitifully low for most salespeople. Now, the moment we measure it, it starts to automatically increase somewhat. But now we start saying, well, hang on, where is your time going? Going back to that A, B, C, and D time, you know, one of the things that we know, Dan, is that we focus on D activities to know where we're wasting all of our time. And we apply this thing, we call it the four Ds. You know, how do we delete them? Shouldn't be done at all. How do we delay them or defer them, do them later? How do we delegate them, get someone else to do that? And then my favorite is, how do we design them out? How can we go back and rework the system so they don't even come up? So going back to the example of RC, it's rather than me telling the contractor, you know, not to call this number anymore, it's me saying, okay, I'm going to point this number over to Joe's phone and he's going to take care of it. So the default behavior becomes the correct one. So if I can identify what is the things that I do that create the most value and what are the activities that lead to those results, that's what I want to focus my people on. And if it's a buyer, direct sales time is a great metric to focus them in on that. Another one could be, what's the number of deals in the pipeline, or what's the number of motivated sellers or qualified buyers that I'm meeting with this week? But I like direct sales time. To me, too many people avoid the behavior of actually meeting with the other party, and that's a good metric to have.
What tool or tracking mechanism? Is it like a grab a notebook, or is there like an app? I mean, you're tracking actual time, and it's on the salesperson to, you know, start the stopwatch, as it were, right?
Is yeah. So I've had
for that.
There is. So I've had clients who have substantial businesses that create app-based ways of doing it. And there are now tools where you can easily do that on an app-based way. However, I'm old school, and I know that to shift behavior, if I can self-do this as I go, it's going to help influence my behavior as a staff member. So I have them just keep a simple index card that they mark on it. At the end of the day, they turn their number in. We plug it into a scoreboard spreadsheet, and there we go. I've got other people who do it even more old school than that. They set a target each day. They say, I want to make sure each day I average 4 hours of sales, direct sales time per day. They put four quarters in one pocket. Every time they do an hour, they move a quarter to the other pocket. I mean, that's old school. That's like, you know, Zig Ziglar old school. But it works. And then I've got other people who are, you know, I've got clients who are in their 30s, and what they do is they literally just, you know, use Trello or some other app that has some flexibility, and they build an app for it, or they take a spreadsheet and turn that into, with some of the overlay app-based services, they turn it into an actual web-based app or a phone-based app. It doesn't matter. As long as I self-score and as long as it's getting looked at daily, that's what matters. Attention has to go there, and it needs to be my attention since I'm the one doing the role. And it needs to be my manager looking at it, since he or she is the one that I look to for feedback on the performance of how I'm doing.
In your experience, specifically in the real estate framework, David, you know, a salesperson like Sean, what would be like an ideal number of hours? What would be like burnout number of hours? And what would be like an unacceptable number of hours if he were reporting to you and you were the manager?
Yeah, so if I have Sean and he's not spending at least one-fifth of his time in direct sales activity, then we're going to have a different conversation. And I have a tool for that I'll come back to in a moment from the Freedom Formula book. I think most are going to be probably somewhere at about 30-40%. If I can get them to 50% or greater, that's phenomenal. So a minimum of one-fifth, 20%. There's no way you're going to ever get Sean to be more on average over a long enough window. He's never going to be more than 50% utilized in direct sales activity. It's just not possible. So if I can get him anywhere from 30 to 40% or higher, I'm doing great. Remember, I might have a week that I have six appointments that just take a huge amount of time. And then I have another week where I have only two deals I'm looking at. Well, it should even out that if I can keep somewhere between 30 and 40% or higher of my time as direct sales time in that role, you're doing great. And here's the comment I have about the tool. So this comes from the second half of the Freedom Formula. And the first half talks about, well, first of all, the book, just for someone listening to this, it's about how do you succeed in business without sacrificing your family, your health, or your life? That's what we wrote it for. And the first half says, how do you operationalize personally working smarter, not harder? You know, what do you do with your time? How do you leverage an assistant? What do you focus on? How do you build strategic depth so you have some backup so you don't end up having to scramble when you lose a key person? The second half of the book says, how do I get my team to work smarter, the actual practical steps? So there's a tool in the second half. We call it can't do, won't do, don't know how. So if Sean's at 10% utilization in terms of direct sales time, and I talk with him, I have to ask the question, is that he can't do more, he won't do more, or he doesn't know how? If it's he can't do it, he's in the wrong role. You know, maybe he should be in my leasing side of my company, or in my on my money raising side, or maybe he should be on my administrative side, or maybe he shouldn't work for me at all. If it's he won't do, I have a direct heart-to-heart and have what I call an adult conversation with Sean. Sean, the current performance is not going to work for me. It does not work. I'm expecting in this role that you're a minimum of 20% utilized or more so that you generate this result. Here's how you know you're doing a great job. Can you do that? Because if you can't, we have a very different conversation to have, Sean. So it's very direct. He knows he's either going to have to do that or he's gone. I don't finesse that. I don't give him 17 times to do that. If he won't do it, and I've talked with him, then I got to get rid of him. He's a cancer, and I can't afford cancer in my company. And then the final one is he just doesn't know how. And that's a training issue. Sean, you know what? You just came on board 2 months ago. You know, Dan and I have been working on the new training system. Let's work to get you up to speed even faster. He needs help. He needs coaching. He needs training to do that better and to see if he can do it or not. That's how I'd approach it.
I like it. Are there any D activities that would be obvious that someone listening could say, all right, time to delete, time to design specifically that Sean, the sales guy, had and maybe worked on as he did this priority himself?
Sure. So funny enough, I find that someone in Sean's role will oftentimes talk with people who are clearly not qualified, or he'll go out on appointments before he's ever qualified the appointment. Why? Sometimes he's doing it because he's so excited that he's got a lead. Sometimes he's doing it because he knows he needs to see a number of people and he's gaming the system a little bit. Hey, I went on an appointment today. Well, yeah, but they weren't qualified. You didn't qualify them beforehand. And so you went there, you know, and this is a person who's got a $300,000 house. They owe $310,000 against it. There's no deal there. No way you're going to get a deal. Lender's not going to take a short sale on that thing. You're screwed. You know, you wasted an hour of driving there and back. You wasted an hour and a half with the seller. That was 2.5 hours. You stopped for lunch on the way back. That was half your day wasted. So that would be an example of a glaring deactivity. Others would include junk email. Sometimes I think people will over research a property in that role before they ever go. I used to have people that I would coach. And then it's like, you know, hey, I got a lead. Great. Well, before I go out there, I'm going to go and I'm going to look down the, you know, online to see who owns the property. And I'm going to see what the mortgages are against it. And I'm going to look at the neighborhood. And they do all this research. And I laugh and I say, well, did you even ever talk with the owner on the phone to see what her situation was, to see if she has a reason for selling? You know, what's her motivation for selling? Is it just because, you know, she thinks she'll get a good price and she's curious what the market is, not a motivated seller? Or is it, hey, she was transferred, the house is empty, and she's concerned about leaving it empty because of vandalism or people breaking in for squatting, right? In which case, I should not wait. I should go right out there to the property and meet with the person. And I think those are some examples of low-value activities that people get sucked into. Office politics, low-value stuff. Let's crowd that stuff out for sure.
So let's go up any level, not keeping our focus on Sean and the salesperson perspective there, but any business owner across the board, David, how can they leverage a VA or maybe hire a personal assistant? What would that look like? What would be scary about that? I have a VA that I've trained up and gotten very good at managing and working with, and it's been tremendous for our business. So would you mind touching on that a little bit?
Sure. I'll give three really concrete suggestions for leveraging an assistant. And for those that are reading the Freedom Formula, check out Chapter 2. But we do this all the time with coaching clients. You know, most of the people we work with, if there are three levels of growing a company, level one is the startup, level two is the owner-reliant company, and level three is the owner-independent company. At level two, you have advanced, early, and middle stage. Early stage is I'm just trying to scramble to get enough revenue coming in that I hit the point of sustainable profitability. Middle stage level two says, hey, this company works. It works well, but I have to be there every day. If I'm not there, the business directly suffers and really can't survive for more than a week or a month without me. And advanced stage level two says, hey, we're a rapid growth company. It's working. I've got good people. I've started to have, you know, the core functions in my business, I've got some other leaders besides myself owning functional areas of the business. We're still, though, owner reliant. If I'm not there, I can be gone for a month, maybe even 2 or 3 months, but longer than that, the business would suffer. So most of the people we work with tend to be middle stage level two or advanced stage level two. They're successful companies, but the owner is still the main player or one of several main players running it. So assistants are huge for them. The problem is that most of the people like that are very scared or uncomfortable with handing over control to somebody else, especially for things that they used to do themselves. They're control freaks. I'm one of them. I'm a control freak. What I've learned is that if I can find If I understand myself, here's the first point. If I understand myself and I find an assistant who matches my style, it becomes a lot easier to let go of control. So, for example, I'm an auditory delegator. I want to record a message for my assistant to do stuff. I don't want to write it. I don't want to type it. I don't want to meet. I'm an introvert. Yes, I can enjoy a conversation like we're having, Dan, but left to my own, you know, I like to be quiet in my office by myself. I don't want to meet. I don't want to have to socialize with my assistant. And whoever I hire, they have to know and be okay with that. Otherwise, they're going to start to question, was David upset with me? Is David not like me? Does he think I'm doing a bad job? And it's drama. I'm a very low drama person. My kids and my wife, plenty of drama there. I don't need the drama at work. I just don't want it. I also need an assistant who can handle a certain level of ambiguity, because while I give instructions, I don't want to have to paint it out with a perfect thing. I want to be able to sketch out what I want him or her to do, and they just get it done. Like Emily, who works with me now, is one of two assistants I work with. She's phenomenal. I can say, hey, can you do something like X? And she's like, oh, yeah, I get it. And she just goes and does it. I delegate through an app that I can leave her an audio message in 1 minute, 30 seconds, 5 minutes. And it makes it much easier for me, where I used to take, you know, I would meet with my assistant, you know, half an hour, an hour once a week. Nowadays, as thoughts come up, I just, you know, drop an audio message with her and she just takes care of it. So that's the first point. Know yourself and find an assistant who really is capable of helping interact in your style. I don't want my assistant to give me audio updates. I want them to type it out. I want them to put all of it into one email and or one app where it's just clear in writing. It takes me less time. I don't have to interact around it. And I sound like a horrible person, but I know my personality. I just don't want the other. I've got other clients who do want the interaction. I've got a guy who likes to delegate by meeting with his assistant. He likes the interaction. Wonderful. He needs someone different than I do. Second one, there has to be one list to rule them all. This is my homage to J.R. Tolkien, right? One ring to rule them all. The idea is that my assistant should put everything that I ask him or her to do on one list. We use Asana for that. I use a different project management tool for the rest of my company, but I've got two assistants, Tiffany and Emily. We use Asana for it. It's simple. It's easy. So if I want to see a status on how they did, all I have to do is look at my feed in Asana. It's called an inbox in that particular app, and lo and behold, it's right there. As long as I see it on that list, I know they're going to get it done. And when I don't see something I've handed off on that list, now I need to train and say, hey, I don't see it on there. I'm uncomfortable. Can you please make sure it's there? As long as it's on the list, we know it's going to have a very high chance of getting done. And the key is, I've seen too many people who, what they'll do, Dan, is they'll put it on the list for their assistant. I'm like, well, hang on a second. Are you their assistant or are they your assistant? They should be writing it on the list, not you, right? And then the final kind of tip I would give is, and this is really hard for people, but get over the discomfort of having your assistant help manage your inbox. There's some functional things you can do, but the big one is a lot of people say, well, what if they see something sensitive? And I laugh and I say, well, first of all, if it's really sensitive, why is it being emailed to you? That's not a particularly secure mechanism, right? For example, my wife and I will email back and forth, and does my assistant see that? Sure, right? My assistant's got the maturity. You know, both Tiffany and Emily are married with kids. They know what happens in a marriage and how things go and the mundane inanities of organizing kids' schedules and other stuff. Of course they know this. They get it. So I hire mature people. I have a non-disclosure part of the contract, but some people are so scared. Well, you know, what if they screw it up? Well, that's a training and a systems thing. You can have that. Emily gets rid of probably 40% of my email before I ever see it. It's wonderful. And the stuff that I see, probably another 20% of what I see, I have her do, as opposed to me. I want her to read my inbox. I want her to see my sent folder. I want her to know what's going on. Because the better she understands what I'm working on, who I'm working with, and who matters and who doesn't matter to me in my business life, the better she can take stuff on and away from me that she just handles in the background, which I really appreciate.
So does Emily work in the same office as you? Do you work virtually most of the time? And what would be, you know, at what point are you looking at your email box? Or do you kind of like watch it and she's like skimming out of the 40%? I mean, how does, you know, that aspect of it work for you and her?
Yeah, so it's a great question, Dan. Functionally, so first of all, I live in Jackson, Wyoming. She lives in Boise, Idaho. And Tiffany, I have a local assistant who works for me about 15 hours a week here locally, who does stuff that can only be done locally. You know, scanning of documents that are right here, making bank deposits on my behalf. When my tires on my car go from snow tires to all season summer tires, she's the one that takes the car in to get that changed over. Be hard. So Emily's 8 hours away. Tiffany's literally in the same community. Tiffany works, comes by my office probably about 1 to 3 hours every Monday and Wednesday. And the rest of it she just does from her home herself. Obviously, Emily never comes over here because she's too far away. So she does all the rest of her hours remotely with that, and it works wonderful. I've had assistants that are on site. I've had assistants that are remote. My preference is I need someone who's local and can come into the office for some of it. It would drive me crazy to have anybody here in my offices, even though my company's virtual. All of our people are different places. I've got an office and a conference room. I wouldn't want any assistant here every single day. 2 days a week is plenty. And if I get an emergency, I need her over, I'll ask for her to come over, and she's been really accommodating if a need be. And then on the other side, the way it works with Emily is she's in my inbox before I get to it. Now, here's the thing. Most people start their day, Dan, the first thing they do is go straight to their inbox, which is the biggest waste of time. And we talk about the value economy versus the time and effort economy. If the first thing I do is go into my inbox, I am working in the time and effort economy. If I want to create value, the first hour of the day, I shouldn't be in my inbox. That's the worst place to be. So she'll do a pass of it. I usually will check my inbox later that morning. She's usually done it first. And we create a folder called Assistant Handled. It's a subfolder of my inbox. And so everything that she's done that she thinks I don't need to really even see, she puts there. And I can do a quick scan and go through just the subject line and the sender. I can go through 100 emails in about 2 minutes to spot the two or three emails that I still think I needed to have looked at. She's already done most everything with it, but I just do one quick double check, once, twice a week on that stuff. On the inbox, we use what we call Quick Steps. It's a function that Microsoft has on its Office Outlook program. It's great. And so I set up a Quick Step for categorizing and moving certain things so that when I look at email, I have a Quick Step that says Assistant Due. And if I click on that with an email, it puts it in a category, Assistant Due. It changes the color of it, and it puts it in an action folder so she knows I want her to handle that. If I see something in the Assistant Handled folder that I thought she shouldn't have put there because it would be an important enough person that it should stay in my inbox where I can see it faster, I put a quick step that says Assistant Leave an Inbox. If it's something that I have for an appointment coming up, she knows to put it in my calendar already as the memo. Like, for example, for this interview, Dan, if I open up that appointment, all the emails that your team and her have exchanged, it's in the appointment memo, so if I do need to see that, it's right there. She's filed it right there. But if I see it first and I want it out of my inbox, I'll click on Assistant Add to Appointment. And she knows that it not only is categorized that way, but it takes it out of my inbox to that action folder, and she knows to put it there to the calendar part. So it just keeps it away from me. It keeps my inbox more manageable. So those are some examples. And then I want her at the beginning of the day and the end of the day to circle back through it. And then during the day, depending what she's working on, she can come back in a couple more times. But I really just want her there at least the beginning of the day before I get there and at the end of the day so that if I put stuff in that action folder, she knows that she needs to do something with it and will do it before the close of the day.
Interesting. And I think you have another priority system on the email that I am ambitiously hoping to bring to my team delicately and get them to adopt.
The 1-2-3 method, I'm glad you bring that up. Again, chapter 2 of the Freedom Formula. And look, the biggest information overload we have most likely for 9 out of 10 people is email. So anything I can do that makes it faster, easier, less energy and attention intensive to do email, the better. So since most email is internally generated, I would say that probably if I look at the average person, half their email is from people inside their company or from a vendor of their company that they do a lot of business with. We use a simple 1-2-3 method in the subject line. A 1 says this is urgent and important. You have to do something with it. Drop everything. Look at it. Do it now. 2 says, hey, you have to take action on this email, but you need to do it in a reasonable time frame. You know, that might be if I read it in the morning by the end of the day, or if I read it in the afternoon by somewhere in the first half of the next day. And a 3 means this is just information only. So what it does is I can send an email to Sean that maybe has a really hot lead. It says, 1, Sean, and it might say 3 for Dan. Say 1, Sean, 3, Dan. So I'm kind of CCing you on here. Hot lead duplex, Cheyenne Street. So Sean sees that and goes, ooh, I need to take action on it right away. You see it, and it's a 3 for you. You know you don't have to do anything. You just glance at the subject line. That's enough for you to know. And if you're curious, you can open it, but you don't have to. And by doing it that way, it lets me look at my inbox and not feel so pressured to stay right on top of it. Like I can do that in batches versus all the time. And then if I have too many ones, I mean, in our company, if I had any team member having probably more than 2 or 3 ones in a month, they're going to have a conversation with me or their manager in the company. Why? That's too urgency driven. Come on, really? You know, we should have been better than that. We should have preempted that. We should have, you know, prevented that. Or it's a little bit melodramatic. That's not a 1. And so I like that because it lowers the burden on my staff. And you think about it. You mentioned you had 30 people at work on your team, Dan. Well, the cost of those 30 people is expensive. If this can save people 5% of their time times 30 people, you've just had an extraordinary, you've got the benefit of an extra full person of savings. That's extraordinary when you compound that through all the people in your company.
And this goes right along with the same high value thinking, the prioritizing of things, the sifting of the wheat from the chaff that's continuously going on with your whole mindset through the books there. And I really love the number 3 category for the email, because the worst ones for me is like we have some title issue going on or some update from some buyer. And what ends up happening is I get forwarded an email chain that has already gone back 15 or 20 times, and I have no clue if there's an action item there, if there's something of importance. It's not even in any logical order by the time I get it. I can't tell what's going on. I got a text. I got to pick the phone up. I got to email back. Is there something I need to pay attention to here? So I'm looking forward to plugging that one in. So what David would be your highest value skill set personally? What are your A and B times look like now?
Yeah. So I'm the 3 things that I'm personally on the payroll for in my company, Maui Mastermind, which is my business coaching company, different from my real estate companies, that I do that create the most value. Number 1. The high leverage promotional spokesperson activities, whether that be, you know, doing a webinar. For example, I'm doing one later on in June that will probably have a couple thousand people on the webinar through SCORE. That would be an example of an activity with that. Number 2, leading my leadership team. That's still one of the core functions I have, leading that team, making sure that we're focusing on the right things, and getting stuff done through them in a big picture way. The 3rd thing that I do in our company is establish what we're about, what we focus on, and what our culture is. This idea that what's the narrative of our business? That you know, we're an advanced stage level 2 business, right on the verge of level 3. We're not quite there yet. We will be in the next year to 3 years. You know, we're trying our very best to eat our own cooking. But as it stands, I'm still, those are the places that I contribute the most value. My B activities include also creating core content themes and tools that our coaching staff can use again and again and again. That would be an example of a B-level activity. Coaching my leadership team for development would be an example of a B-level activity for me. the biweekly executive team leadership meetings that I run. That would be an example of a B-level activity in my company. So again, here's the thing. My B activities and A activities might be different than somebody else's. And if what I have as an A activity today is still an A activity 3 years from now, I've failed. I need to keep growing. I need to keep climbing that value ladder. What's an A activity for me this year, I would hope I could push down to a B activity next year. And what's a B activity next year, hopefully is a C or D activity the year after that as I continue to grow my business's ability to create value versus me personally producing the value.
What is the definition, remind me, of level three? Is fully autonomous or what, can be sold completely?
Yeah.
What would be like?
It's an owner-independent company. It's a business that really can thrive and run without the owner. And that sounds lofty, but here's what it would look like. A friend of mine who I wrote the book Build a Business Not a Job with, who is a former client of mine, her name's Stephanie Harkness, in her business, she could literally go away for her company for 2 or 3 months and come back, and the business would not just be okay, it would actually be better than it was when she left it. She still worked in the company because she loved it, but it was a choice. It wasn't an obligation or a necessity. She had leaders in all the key pillars. She still owned the CEO role, but the business could very well get along without her. That's a level three business. It's now an exit stage company. I could sell it. I could continue to scale it, or I could transition and just own it passively. A lot of our clients, when they reach that point, I mean, look, the reason why a lot of people invest in real estate is they love the fact that they can have an asset passively producing income and appreciating in value. Well, for a lot of people, the number one appreciating asset that can generate passive income for them is a business that they go passive in. I can generate more cash flow per dollar of equity from a business outside of a real estate company than I ever could with a real estate company. I can generate 20-30% or more cash return on equity and cash from a business. I can't do that from real estate very easily. That's not realistic. Now, I still like real estate. I still invest in real estate. I'm a big believer in it, but it serves a different function. So an exit stage company can allow me to go passive, to sell it, or to just continue to grow it, depending what I want to do.
How do you view your real estate investment business and activities these days, knowing that the, you know, I assume right now I'm taking an assumption that the coaching business is the 20-30% and you got a much greater ROI on time, your leverage and things of that nature. So what function does the real estate side play for you?
So I'm going to make an admission here. I find real estate fairly boring today. After doing it all these years, I don't really find it very intellectually stimulating. So I don't really, that's not where I want my growth energy to go. However, from a financial standpoint, it's a great place for a portion of my net worth. And I'm good at it. And so I'll do it. Generally today, I do it passively. I'm either a money partner in someone else's deal. Or I still have some legacy stuff that I have professional management in place for stuff that I actively was participant in the buying of it. My kids are young. Now, what will I feel like when my kids are in their, you know, late teens, early 20s? Then they don't want to be around me as much. Well, you know, I'm hoping my kids will want to buy some properties with me. I'd love to do some houses with my kids as a teaching mechanism and just to spend time. They're a little young for that now. So I think of myself, here's the analogy I used in the Freedom Formula, which was this idea of an astronaut. An astronaut has a certain amount of consumables, of oxygen, of fuel. And so for me, I set that I'm going to make sure that I work no more than 40 hours per week, and I'm going to take a minimum of 10 weeks of vacation every year. That, for me, is my consumables. And so I've got 40 hours to work with, and I've got 42 work weeks at max to work with. How am I going to invest that across all my businesses and financial activities? For me, the majority, 85-90% of my business life goes toward the active business coaching company that I'm growing. The ROI is there. It's intellectually very stimulating and rewarding, creative. And then probably about 5-8% of my energy goes to my real estate that I do passively, and then the balance goes to things like taxes and you know, estate planning and all that other kind of junk. I don't really enjoy it, but I know that I need to do it.
Well said, well said. The running of a virtual assistant for me, hosting this podcast show, writing a book personally on wholesaling years ago, all that helped me to, I think I want to say, kind of level up my own thinking. It makes me pay attention to different nuance, different detail. I hear a story on Mastery, and it would talk about I forget who it was, maybe Leonardo da Vinci, and he would like hang out there and he would look at just these little pieces of the way that these flowers would grow. And I might have the artist wrong. But later on he, and I think it was da Vinci, and he would be out there for like as a young man and probably a teenager, even younger than that. And he would just like observe them for hours and hours on end and like see so much more depth and things that are there that a lot of other people have not. And I feel like my own personal journey has been almost taking an artist perspective to my business, right? Our house flipping machine, our business, everything we do, the way we think about it, we bring that all together. And I feel like being the author and having to become better at thinking through and choosing my words and figuring out how people are going to receive this has been a big driver in what we've been able to create so far. Do you find a similar, I mean, you talk about the intellectual stimulation, but, you know, having written your thoughts in so many books over the years, and I'm sure so many business plans and things of that nature, I mean, do you think some of that has come into play and been kind of a strength for you over the years, or just happened?
No, I mean, I would agree with you. I think that probably one of the things that I'm really good at is I see simple structure in complex situations. And I, whenever I look at something, I see how would I prioritize and how would I sequence it. I'm really good at that. And partly because my brain doesn't like complexity. My brain has to simplify for me to feel comfortable and to use stuff. I can get overwhelmed too easily. And that's been really good in a business setting. In terms of the books or the other things that I write, I find for me that it's a great place for me now to kind of codify or organize my thinking. And then I've always had a value in my business, as we call it, we eat our own cooking, that now there's an advantage, right? Now, someone once said, David, what's your biggest strength for building your company? And I said, well, you know, doing what we coach our clients to do. If we can follow what we coach our clients to do, that's the best practice. You know, for example, you know, three of my leadership team members have internal Maui coaches. Why? Because it works. We follow our own quarterly process, our own weekly process. And, you know, I would tell anyone it's an aspirational goal. We're not perfect at it, nor will we ever be, but we're better this quarter than we were last quarter. And next quarter will be better still. So I'd like to think, and I think this is a kind of a good point to kind of, I won't say conclude on, but wrap up into, which is this idea that I feel strongly that anyone listening to this is going to have certain strengths in their investing. You know, some of them are going to be great negotiators. Others are going to be really good about designing a home on a rehab that can just, the home just flies off the market and sells. Others are going to be really good on the analytic side or the financing side. Whatever your strength is, here's something I'm going to say that's really counterintuitive, that if you plan on growing bigger than just a small mom and pop, that one of the things you might consider is how can you leverage yourself in the area that's a strength for you by getting somebody else in there with you. Like the first place is obviously to leverage the places you're horrible at or the places you struggle with. You know, if I'm a great deal finder, but I'm not good administratively or operationally, I need that person. But assuming I have that and I've got that, the place for me to grow next after that is counterintuitive. It's actually finding somebody else to duplicate me in my area of strength. And I'll tell you, Dan, that's one of the hardest things for someone to do, yet it's easy to do. What it means is, for example, I'm really good at teaching, training, doing that kind of work. That's a great strength of mine. For me to know who else is really good at it and to make sure that they're good at it, I can do that much easier than in an area of the business that I'm not good. So once I've got somebody or a grouping of people that cover my weaknesses, the next place I look for is somebody to duplicate my area of strength so that I don't get stuck operationally doing the thing I'm good at, but might not be the highest use of my time simply because I'm the only one who's good at it. That's the next place for growth.
Makes sense. Yeah, solid. Three more questions and then we'll do the plugs. That work?
That works. And I'm sorry. I know I answer things in detail, which is a strength and a weakness.
It's magnificent. This has been a great episode so far. I really appreciate you doing this with me. So the first is not necessarily business related specifically, but I always like to, you know, mention or ask kind of behind the scenes to see if you have any personal habits, routines, lifestyle choices that maybe are helpful and additional to kind of your success. So one of the things that you've already kind of mentioned is that you limit the number of hours and you're very diligent about how you're going to invest those hours to get a certain return. So are there things happening outside of those hours that you feel contribute to you bringing your best self to your business?
Sure. I mean, the straightforward one is exercise. As I'm approaching 50 in the next several months, I want to make sure, you know, 6 days a week or 7 days a week I'm exercising. Here's a strange one in terms of the behavior that's going to probably mean the most to people listening to this from a financial standpoint. If you're married, stay married. And I know that seems trite to say that. Some of my closest friends have had divorces. My wife and I, who've been together for 23 years, between our parents have been married 7 times between them. I mean, it's ridiculous. But the reality is, I have a lot of clients that at various times, you know, they're very interested in building wealth and building companies and so forth. But, you know, if I can stay married, I'm going to be not just keeping all of what we have, but I won't lose 2 years of my life to the emotional turmoil of the divorce. So I know it's a tough one. I'm married to a psychologist. We talk all the time about, you know, how do we improve the relationship? How do we do this? I just would simply say, if it's at all practical and there's no abuse going on, if you can find a way to make that work, there's probably nothing you can do financially that will have a bigger impact than doing that. And the final habit I would just share, and I find this important for me, is several times a week, I keep a weekly journal where I just add each time I write in, I'll put down what were some of the steps I took toward goals that I have? What were some of my magic moments? What are some of the blessings in my life? And it's usually about a page or 2 pages in the journal every week that I write. But it helps me just pay attention to all the good stuff that's going on in my life versus being the person who's constantly scrambling to achieve more. I'm not that guy anymore. But a decade ago, I was that guy who would pass right by the blessings in his life looking to accomplish that next thing. And that's not a good place to live. Not very fulfilling.
I like it. So what 2 books, David, do you recommend most often to your coaching clients? And it could be business, it could be real estate, it could be something totally outside of that, but what would be those 2 books, if any?
Yeah, so if it's a business book, I still think the book I wrote, Scale, is probably the best book for entrepreneurs that I've seen on the market. I wrote it with my friend Jeff Hoffman, who was the co-founder of Priceline.com. So Scale. And if it's more of a personal book, there's a lovely book written by a guy by the name of Clayton Christensen. The book is called How Will You Measure Your Life? It is a wonderful book, and I've recommended it a lot. And I'll give a third one, I can't help myself, which is a book called Less is More by one of the world's nicest people. Unfortunately, he passed away a couple weeks ago. His name's Jason Jennings. He's just a truly good human being. And the book is called Less is More. And it's a fantastic business book. It was written 20 plus years ago, but it's a great business book.
All right. Now, David, I'm going to select 2007 because 2007 was 2 years after you sold the coaching company. And it was also a very interesting time for our country, similar in some respects to kind of what we're looking at now. In other words, we were on the precipice, but then 2008, 9, and 10, we know what took place there. And that may or may not have affected everybody listening to the call. But if you could go back and share the crown jewel of wisdom, knowing what you know now, with yourself back in 2007, what would that be?
You know, I'm going to say something that's probably a little bit counterintuitive or different than you were expecting. So for me, if I could go back to 2007, I would tell myself, look, relax. no matter what you do, you're going to be successful financially. I mean, that is the truth. But what you're not going to realize and what you don't know is that some of the relationships and people in your life, the health that you're enjoying right now, there's going to be things that pass in your life that you're not even going to notice if you're not careful. So I would tell myself to take more pictures, to enjoy the moments of my life more, to be less concerned about, you know, progress and achievement, and much more open to just savoring and appreciating all the gifts there. You know, most people who are going to listen to this, they're going to do well or extraordinarily well financially. But the people I meet, I mean, I see it all the time with clients that now a lot of our clients are in their 60s or 70s. They've sold companies, and I've got these friendships with them, and it's not about the money anymore. It's like, wow, the regrets they have are not about how they could have done another, you know, office building or 100 more houses or, you know, scaled their company better. The regrets that they have are the relationships they took for granted or the moments that they took for granted. And that's what I would tell myself. Just enjoy the heck out of it because it goes very quick.
Wow, I love it. So how can listeners get more David Finkel?
Well, first of all, you can go to our website, MauiMastermind.com. So MauiMastermind.com, MauiMastermind.com. And there are two resources I would point them to that are a given. So first of all, they can get a copy of Build a Business, Not a Job for free. If they want the hardcover sent to them, they're going to pay shipping and handling. If they want the Kindle or the PDF version, they can just download it off our site. And then also on that same site, there's a business growth toolkit there that has 5 small video courses, operations, lead generation, marketing, time management. They're all right there. We've always believed that the best way to kind of work with somebody is to give them a real taste of what we do. And then the right people tend to kind of bubble with the surface. The final resource on that site, if someone really is serious who's listening to this and recognizes that you can do more with coaching, and I want to be clear here, while many of our coaches work with real estate investment companies, it's probably one of our third largest practice areas as a coaching company, we don't teach people how to invest in real estate. If you're not already savvy in how to do the investing, what we do is we help you build the company that invests in real estate better, not to teach people about how to buy subject to the existing financing or how to do an AITD or how to raise capital. That's not what we do. We help people to build the business that does that so that you can have more time freedom and more scalability. But if that's something someone's serious about, Dan, on MauiMastermind.com, there is a place there that they can actually pick a time with one of our coaching staff to do a free coaching session for an hour and a half. And depending on that conversation, it gives them the chance to experience what it's like to work with us, gives us a chance to see what it's like to work with you, and then both of us can make a good decision if it's a fit after doing that. So there's some free resources and one that would lead to, if someone did want to have a relationship with a paid coach, that's another option for them as well.
Is there some exercise or some maybe one-page document or questions? Is there anything that a listener should do to get prepared for that free coaching call, like I didn't do when I shared my story?
Yeah.
To be,
so we've gotten better on the systems in the last 12 years now. So when they do schedule their time on that, we will actually send them a short mini audit. I believe it's 10 or 12 questions that will get them to make sure they have all the right information at hand. And we do recommend doing that while you're not driving, but you know,
yeah.
I'm not going to go back and give you a hassle about that, Dan. Although I laughed when you said that, because right there on the web form today, it says, try not to be in a car. We don't want to cause an accident for somebody, you know, heaven forbid.
I'm sure I was like merging lanes with the phone up to the ear. Like, yeah, it was, I'm sure it was not a good situation at all.
Cause of accident, not texting, no, coaching while driving. Oh, no, that's a no-no.
Oh, that's cool. So, hey, is there anything else I forgot to ask or that you'd like to share with listeners before we get wrapping up here, David?
No, I don't think so at all. I think you did a great job with that. And again, to your listeners, I wish you every success doing what you're doing. And if I could give one piece of advice, kind of ending with this, is don't just invest in real estate. Build a business that invests in real estate. The difference is lifestyle. And I think that's an important difference.
All right. Well said. Well, hey, thank you again for coming on the show, David. It has been a pleasure. I have pages and pages of notes here, a lot of takeaways, and I really appreciate you blocking out the time here and sharing with us. I hope we were A or B time, but I really appreciate you giving so generously with all of these takeaways. Thank you, David.
You're welcome, Dan.
And thank you for tuning in to this episode of the REI Diamond Show. Are you interested in early notification of future episode releases? You can subscribe on YouTube or through podcasting apps such as iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Podcasts, among others. Just search REI Diamonds and click subscribe. You can also sign up to receive the weekly new episode notification email at reidiamonds.com. as well as check out the money-making, idea-packed episodes in the archive. That site, again, is www.reidiamonds.com. So my main business, Dan Breslin here, my main business is buying and selling houses. 223 bought and sold in 2019, and 107 bought and sold so far in 2020. We currently have 96 deals in the inventory, either under construction, for sale, or sold and awaiting closing. I share that because there are three ways that you and I can do business. Number one, if you buy houses in Atlanta, Chicago, or the Philadelphia regions, which also includes New Jersey and Delaware, go to dealswithroi.com. That's www.dealswithroi.com. And sign up for the correct buyers list. There are five in total, and those are separated by region. Number two, if you are an accredited investor and you would like to fund a deal or even many deals, go to fundrehabdeals.com and sign up to receive private mortgage investment opportunity emails. Those would be passive investments on deals that I am managing and running through my team through Diamond Equity Investments. Again, the website is www.fundrehabdeals.com. And third, if you have a deal, preferably a fix and flip, but I will buy turnkey single family and turnkey multifamily deals in either Atlanta, Chicago, or the Philadelphia tri-state region, please send me an email with the details. You should have my email if you've gotten the email with this episode, or you can sign up at reidiamonds.com and just reply to that email or add me to your buyers list. So up next on the show, we have XP3 Talent System founder Mike Matalone joining us here to do a deep dive on how to hire, train, and retain A players. This episode is pertinent for me for a few reasons, one of which being the growth of my company, Diamond Equity, over the years, is a direct result of my luck in attracting and maintaining partnerships with the A players who make up our business. This business would not exist if it were not for my team, our team here. The second reason Mike's appearance is right on time for me is that Diamond Equity is actually looking for a few more A players to round out the Southeastern regional team, which includes the Atlanta and Jacksonville metro, Atlanta, Georgia, and Jacksonville, Florida metro markets. So send me an email if you know of anyone looking for a rewarding career in real estate actually doing deals. Anyway, if you plan on scaling a business anytime in the future, you'll be wise to grab a pen and catch that next episode, and of course a pad to take notes. So until then, my friend, stay safe and close a few more deals.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin. To receive email notifications of new weekly episodes, sign up at www.reidiamonds.com.